Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Imagine if the buttery, sweets, and rich, savory dishes that were everywhere during the holidays were as good for us as, say, steamed vegetables and brown rice. When pigs fly, right? Still, it might just be possible to turn that wish upside down, to train our palates so that a beautiful green salad or perfectly broiled piece of fish tastes every bit as satisfying as the omnipresent party foods we have to wean ourselves off of every January. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Evolution gave us a taste for sugar, salt, and fat, although our ancestors never dreamed of eating them in the quantities available to us today. But no matter how entrenched we believe our tastes to be, our individual food preferences are subject to change, which is great news for wary toddlers suspicious about those carrots on their plates, and also for grown-ups who understand that what we eat can have a lot to do with how we feel. Historian and food writer Bea Wilson is here to talk about that. Her new book is called First Bite: How We Learn to Eat. Bea, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You write that before we can change what we eat, we need to change what we like. How do we come to like or dislike particular foods in the first place?
Well, I think if you asked most people how we like foods, they would just say, well, it's just part of my personality. We see these things as being innate. Our food preferences are such a familiar part of ourselves, it's as if they follow us around like a comforting shadow. But when you look into the science of how we gravitate towards this or that food, actually the opposite is true. Almost all of our responses to flavour are acquired rather than innate. Every human being is born with a strong preference for sweetness and a mild aversion for bitterness, but there is nothing in our physiology that says we're destined to grow up and love cupcakes more than kale.
The way we eat is all about what we've been taught, therefore. So how do caregivers begin teaching us to eat without maybe even realizing they're doing it?
They begin teaching us how to eat, well, before we're even born. We're picking up flavors from our mother's diet. There have been extraordinary studies done showing that amniotic fluid actually has a flavor. Mothers-to-be who were given a lot of garlic capsules, when the amniotic fluid was then tested, it was found to have a strong garlicky aroma. And there have also been studies done showing that mothers who drink a lot of carrot juice in the last trimester of pregnancy, as late as 6 months after birth, when babies are first weaned onto solid foods, those babies showed a marked preference for carrot-flavoured cereal over plain cereal. So some of the cues we're giving to our babies are based on simply the flavours they acquire, first in pregnancy and then through breast milk if you're breastfeeding. But I think a lot of it is really to do with our own inherited attitudes to food. We offer foods that we've put in a category as sort of being health foods in a completely different way from the way that we offer a child a treat. And so many of our hang-ups and problems to do with food are to do with this polarity between what's healthy on the one hand and what's pleasure-giving on the other hand. It's extremely hard to eat well when you think what is pleasurable is not good for you. We're only going to improve our food habits if we can somehow get to the point where we can change enough of our likes so that we end up liking what's good for us. And then you don't need to go on a diet. You don't need willpower. You simply carry on eating what you like. It's great.
These days, the World Health Organization recommends feeding breast milk exclusively for the first 6 months and then adding in other foods gradually. If we do this, I learned from your book that we miss a kind of magical window in which babies are inclined to eat just about anything that you put in their mouths.
Yes, there is an amazing flavor window, it seems, between the ages of 4 and 7 months, when human beings are more receptive to new flavors than there will ever be again in the rest of their lives. It's not to say you can't learn new flavors later. You can, right? Into old age, you can learn new flavors. But this is a particularly magical moment when it seems that babies who've tasted certain vegetables at that point, it will imprint them with a liking for those vegetables so that when they encounter them later as a fussy toddler, it's going to be less of a battle. The World Health Organization advice is based largely on the situation of mothers in the developing world, where exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months is excellent advice because there are so many issues to do with hygiene once you start feeding a child anything other than milk. In a country like the United States, actually what happens is most mothers go back to work well before 6 months because maternity leave is so short. So the vast majority of babies have been moved on to formula milk by that point, which has, you know, I'm not going to get into the whole breast milk versus formula milk debate, but purely on the question of flavour, formula milk has a completely consistent, homogenous flavour profile in contrast to breast milk, which is more varied. So it would be far better from the point of view of trying to encourage a child to become a varied eater later on in their life to expose them to a range of different flavours at that point. And there have been studies done showing if you can take a 4 to 6 month old baby and give them a smorgasbord of different vegetables, not just the sweet ones that we tend to give them, such as sweet potato and pumpkin, but spinach and swede and turnip and any kind of vegetable you can think of in a rapid rotation, they will then be more open-minded about food later on.
What happens, as many people know, that window of tasting just about everything, accepting just about everything, slams shut once babies become toddlers. What's going on there?
Well, it's actually a really good way that babies have to protect themselves. It's an evolutionary device where in hunter-gatherer societies, toddlers, that would have been the first point that you would have been tasting food outside of the home. So it was quite correct to be wary of toxins. The problem, as with so many of our eating habits, is that it's long outlived its evolutionary advantage. And now what it means is that toddlers are wary of exactly those foods that parents would most like them to eat, notably green bitter vegetables. But
oh, go ahead.
Sorry. No, I mean, but neophobia is what it's called, and it's fear of the new. And it is a classic developmental stage, but it's very hard. I mean, I certainly made this mistake with my third child, who was by far my fussiest. It's really hard not to think, oh no, they're never going to like these foods. And to recognise that it's just a stage and to sit it out is one of the most difficult things. And I know I didn't deal with it very well myself.
I was always bothered when my children were young about kids' menus in restaurants that seemed to suggest that the only things that you could expect children to eat were like hot dogs and macaroni and cheese and potatoes. Is it a mistake to give children what is sometimes called kid food?
Yes, it's a huge mistake. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if we assume that a child will only eat something that's smothered in ketchup and contains no vegetables and is largely centered on French fries, then that's what they'll get accustomed to. The main thing that we know about how our likes are acquired is that they're acquired through exposure. Our liking is largely simply familiarity. We like the things that taste like home. So if you never get exposed to a range of foods, including vegetables, you're not going to like them. And if you keep getting exposed to French fries and hot dogs and grilled cheese sandwiches, lovely as those things are in moderation, but if that's the only flavour that goes into your mouth, then each time you're having it, it's reinforcing your liking. And so then people say, well, this is all my kid will eat. But of course it's all they will eat because they haven't been given the opportunity to try anything else.
Do we know anything, Bea, about why just about everybody has at least a couple of foods that they simply cannot abide for no good reason? I've been exposed to bananas every day for 45 years, and I still just don't want anything to do with them.
Well, I mean, the thing I should add in to the thing about exposure is, well, first of all, it has to be exposure in a positive context. So forcing a child to eat something is never a good idea, but even pressurizing someone to eat something, you're saying, finish that soup. There have been studies done showing that gives children very negative feelings about the soup. So it may be at some point someone forced you to have too many bananas. The other reason people dislike foods is nausea. You might have forgotten it, but there might have been some point in the past where you got sick soon after having some bananas. And it's very difficult to overcome those feelings of nausea and disgust. disgust is quite a primal human emotion. And as with neophobia, it's a form of self-preservation. It seems to be a very useful human emotion, or it was in the early stages of our evolution. And it's still quite a profound one. I mean, it's visceral. So it is hard to overcome our relationship with a certain food if we've reached that stage of just outright disgust. But if you're in a state of more just kind of wariness or unfamiliarity with something, you absolutely can get over it. And I suspect your bananas, well, you probably can live without bananas.
I can. I can and I will. But I suppose if I were hungry enough, I could probably choke one down.
Yeah.
So I hadn't heard before reading your book of Dr. Clara Davis, but wow, her research is both fascinating and, as it turns out, often misinterpreted over the years.
Yes, it was a very famous experiment. Clara Davis was a pediatrician from Chicago, and she began doing this experiment in 1926 in a hospital in Cleveland, and she would never have got away with it ethically now. But it was an extraordinary experiment, and what she was trying to do was figure out what would children's tastes look like if they could be totally separated from all of the usual social influences that parents and doctors and other people put on children to eat this and not that. And what she did was she took a series of babies aged from 6 months up to about 11 months who had never had a single bite of solid food. And some of them were orphans and some of them were the children of single mothers. This is why it's so unethical. She just took them away and put them in this experimental orphanage in a hospital. And she completely controlled the foods that they were offered. And they were offered nothing but a range of totally pure, whole, unprocessed foods, ranging from peaches to lettuce to milk, beef, liver, kidneys, various cereals. And they were offered in a totally neutral, passionless way by a nurse who was to sit by and just allow the children to reach for what they wanted to reach. And it, by this method, each of the children was able to find for themselves a totally nutritionally adequate and balanced and varied diet. And the interesting thing was they all had different tastes. They didn't all go for the same foods. But out of the range of foods they were offered, they were able to cure rickets in one case. They had an adequate amount of vitamins. The way the experiment has often been read is to say, well, just let kids eat whatever they want to eat. They'll be fine. You know, our tastes are actually a signal telling us what our body needs. There's this phrase, the wisdom of the body, that was much bandied around by pediatricians in the mid-20th century. But it turns out that's completely the wrong way to read the experiment. Clara Davis herself noted that there was a trick to the way she'd set it up, which was that all of the foods the children were being offered were pure and good and whole foods. So in that kind of setting, it doesn't actually really matter what kind of preferences you have. You're going to be fine. Whereas, as she pointed out, in the 1930s, well, let alone the present day, actually the sort of foods children were being exposed to were packaged foods, white bread, pastries, cookies. So in that setting, she said, the message you need to take is that nutrition should be left in the hands of elders where it has always belonged. And children are not innately capable of selecting the diet which will do them the most good.
We're speaking this hour with food writer and historian Bea Wilson. Her new book is called First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with historian and food writer Bea Wilson. Her new book is called First Bite: How We Learn to Eat. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Bea, is it fair to say that in cultures like ours where food is readily available, we tend to be oversensitive to physical hunger?
I think so. I think we just aren't very good at dealing with hunger. But this was one of the most fascinating subjects that I researched for the book. I really didn't realize how complex hunger was before I got into the science of it. I somehow imagined hunger was one of the simplest things about eating. You feel hungry, you eat, you feel full. And when you start to look into the science of the various biomarkers and hormonal markers that people have tried to identify for how can you actually say that someone is not hungry or hungry, it becomes immensely complex. And you see that hunger, in common with the rest of our eating, is a deeply emotional thing. And the foods that it takes to satisfy us are often, it's not just about the nutrients, it's about the associations. Does it remind us of home? And they're strongly culturally determined. The foods that will make someone hungry in one country are not the same as the foods that will satisfy someone in another place.
I was thinking about the fact, I don't know if this is a thing in the UK, but in the US someone will say, well, are you hungry? And sometimes the response will be, I could eat, which is not the same as being hungry. It's like, you know, I could take in food right now.
I like that. Okay, I haven't heard that. No, I don't think we say that so much. I don't know if many of us are hungry much of the time anymore. I came across this astonishing statistic from someone called Professor Barry Popkin, which showed that in the States, the length of time between meals, or as they're referred to in the literature, eating opportunities, because it often isn't really a meal, is it? It's a snack eaten as you're walking around on the hoof. But it used to be that children in 1977 would go 4.1 hours between snacks, which isn't that long. And now it's 3.1 hours. That in and of itself accounts for a huge amount of the excess calories that we're taking in. But it's so hard to push ourselves to go that little bit longer, to actually experience the sensation of hunger without getting into a panicky state. And I know this is something, I mean, one of my starting points for the book is that I'm someone who, you know, I now feel really quite fine about food. I don't think I have too many hang-ups or issues. I don't go on diets. But back as a teenager and in young adulthood, I was profoundly unhappy in my eating. I would describe myself as a sort of cross between a compulsive eater and a yo-yo dieter. And hunger was something that made me feel very uncomfortable. Whereas now I've somewhat learnt to make friends with hunger. I think I've learnt to get to the point where I know I'm going to enjoy the next meal so much more if I allow myself to feel at least a little bit peckish. There's this phrase the French have, hunger is the best sauce. But in common with so many of the other ways of eating that we need to master in order to actually nourish ourselves, it's something a lot of us have forgotten.
How do we come to associate food with comfort?
Ah, well, food just is comfort right from the moment we're born. We're given love and food at the same time by our parents. So it's only natural that later on we could be forgiven for thinking that sugar and love are the same thing. And they do feel remarkably similar much of the time. Food is security. It's the particular scent of our mother's cooking is something so profound. It's something that anchors us. And when you look into the science of the human olfactory system, you see that, I hadn't realized this either, that our brain, so much of our brain is taken up with the question of processing flavor. Around 5% of human genes are olfactory receptors, suggesting that our interaction with the flavors of the world around us, it's part of what makes us human, and it's part of what gives us our sense of self. So no wonder we're emotional about food.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Pulkit on the line in Kapel. Hi, Pulkit.
Hi. thanks so much for taking my call. This is an amazing topic. So coming from someone who's unfortunately didn't get trained in such a way to love, you know, parsnips and healthy food, I struggle with this question a lot about how do I, eat healthy while still enjoying my meal. And so I was wondering if the guest could suggest any research or any sort of companies that are doing any sort of, research into this area of food that is kind of engineered for your typical adult palate, which enjoys sugars and fats and that kind of thing, but it is also somehow healthy. I don't know if the two have been melded in any sort of way, or maybe there's a new way of engineering healthy food so that it, fits better with your traditional palate. But any sort of thoughts on that topic would be really helpful. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
So my answer to that would be, you are the person who can re-engineer your own palate. I mean, the food companies are endlessly coming out with new products which claim that they're going to be both healthy and somehow appeal to a sugary palate at the same time. But often I think it's fool's gold. I really share your predicament, because I used to be like this myself, and I never thought that I could change the way I ate. And it's a slow, often difficult process. You should allow it to take months, if not years. It's not like going on a diet at all. But I mean, you're saying you don't like vegetables like parsnips, but one thing would be, if there's something outright repulses you, don't go there. But if there's something where you think, well, if I try this in a really small dose and then again in another small dose alongside my comfort foods, what you may find is over a period of weeks or months, you can up the amount of whatever the food might be, kale or salad. So if you can get to the point where the slice of pizza gets smaller and the portion of kale gets larger, I think that's a pretty good way to eat. One of the mistakes people make with dieting is that they discard all of their comfort foods straight away. So they put the diet food in the category of something I don't like, and then the comfort foods are the things you really are desperate to get back to. Whereas if you can just eat the two alongside one another and slowly increase your repertoire, that's the way to go. It's not easy, and I applaud you for even trying. There has been new research done. Most of it's been done with kids, but the people I spoke to who run the feeding clinics say it absolutely does work with adults too, which is tiny tastes. So if there's a vegetable that you wanted to work on adding into your repertoire, don't try a whole portion straight away, because you probably are going to find that horrible. But if you could just try a piece as small as a pea, and then don't force yourself to try any more today, wait till tomorrow, try another piece the size of a pea. The aim is not to be ingesting huge amounts of nutrients from these foods straight away, but actually to re-engineer your own tastes till you get to the point where you want to eat these foods.
I've been thinking since reading your book about the context and how that affects the way we feel about foods. For instance, I'm sure you've met people who say, I don't like raisins in bread, but I'm happy to eat a dish of raisins, or vice versa. Mm. They're the same food, but somehow they're acceptable to us in one context and not in the other.
Yeah, context is a huge thing. And there are certain things we would eat when we're on holiday or in a different setting, at a friend's house, maybe we'll try things. And sometimes this change of context can be something very powerful. I've spoken to people who say it was only when they moved abroad for work that suddenly they were able to break through their own pickiness, because none of their familiar comfort foods were there. So they were forced to try new foods, and gradually they came to seem more familiar. But yeah, it is curious, that thing, that there are certain things that seem right. I mean, there are certain things that we put in the category of breakfast foods, and others that would just seem completely wrong in the morning, even though we might like them at dinner time.
Yeah, in the West, like strong flavors like pickles seem very strange in the morning, and yet there are other places where that's the way you start your day.
Exactly. In Ukraine, something like a pickled gherkin alongside some fried eggs, delicious. But yeah, it just seems wrong. And I just becoming more open-minded in general about the categories we put different foods into is part of how to change our relationship with eating.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Tom is on the line in Plano. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Chris, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Oh, good. Really loved your show from Washington last week, or was it the week before? But it was really great.
Thank you
so much. You know, Half Price Books has a million cookbooks for very little money. And if you just understand that eating is life, and if you don't take time to do this for yourself, there really isn't going to be a whole lot of fun otherwise. And just really explore various nationalities, because there's so many healthy foods of every different nationality, and you just have to balance out what's good for yourself. You know, carbs are, everybody loves them, but they don't love anybody. And so, you know, you just have to find what's good for you. But if you don't spend time doing things like cooking your food and understanding what you're putting in your body, the rest of it really doesn't matter. So, you know, take time to cook good food and enjoy the new year.
What do you think, Bea?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I mean, I think if you are someone who's lucky enough to enjoy cooking and enjoy exploring different cuisines, then absolutely half the battle is won. But I also think it's worth remembering that for some people, this is a huge struggle. I mean, for example, there's a huge hidden shame of a lot of people who are in the category which would be called adult picky eaters, who are so selective in what they eat that they might be down to just a couple of foods, maybe potato chips and hot dogs. And it's like a profound, almost physical aversion to anything else. It's a little bit like growing up unable to read. They might avoid social situations where they're going to have to eat an unfamiliar food. And I appreciate what the listener said, but it's not necessarily just about taking the time. Often it's a really profound form of eating or feeding disorder, which someone has to find a way to conquer. And I think usually the first stage is recognizing that it's possible to change, because when you're living with one of these conditions, you know, obviously anorexia and bulimia and binge eating are other ways that eating goes wrong and becomes unhappy. But when you're living with one of these conditions, it's such a way of life. Eating is such a habitual activity. It forms all of our days, that much as you might want to become someone that cooks and tries different cuisines, it seems like another planet. It's really hard to get from before to after. But yes, once you're in the other stage, like the listener, and you're enjoying the whole world of food, that's a wonderful place to be.
I was fascinated to learn, you know, so many people want to cut back on salt in their diets, but it's everywhere, and then you taste food without it, and it feels pretty bland. Going on a low-salt diet for just a matter of weeks can be enough to reset your palate.
Yeah, this was a really interesting study showing that people who went on a low-salt diet for a period of 8 to 12 weeks, by the end of that time, they had a different relationship with salt. Their palates had changed. They no longer got the same pleasure from the high-sodium versions of things like crackers and chicken broth. And I think that's a really powerful example of how we can change. It's just that when you're at the point of seeking out the super salty foods every day. I like salt, by the way, but I think we're looking at situations where someone might need to go on a low sodium diet, or in these packaged foods which are extremely high in salt. It's possible actually to get to the point where salt is no longer such a pleasure. And there've been similar studies done with sugar, showing that you can actually rewire your response to sugar over just a few weeks. The hard part is actually making yourself stick with it for a period of a few weeks so that you can actually achieve the change.
You don't actually have, you know, menu suggestions in the book, but the one food you do recommend people think more carefully about is soup. What's so special about eating soup?
Well, there's a reason why those books are called Chicken Soup for the Soul. One of the holy grails of modern nutrition is searching for the food that will really fill us up and keep us satisfied for longer. And nutritionists have looked at various nutrients. Is it protein? Is it fat? Is it fiber? But there have been some remarkable studies done showing that one of the foods that most fills us up is soup, even though the main constituent is water. So that suggests it's not really about the calories in and of themselves or the nutrients. It's the idea of soup. And there was a study done showing if you took an identical glass of apple juice, you could serve it to people cold as a drink, or you could heat it up and call it apple soup. And when you heated it up and served it to people as soup, they actually felt fuller an hour later. So there's something in this idea of soup that somehow nourishes us deep down. And as with so much of our eating, it's in the brain as much as in the stomach.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Kayla is on the line now in Denton. Hi, Kayla.
Hi. I had a question about whether or not you knew how the relationship between anxiety and depression affects eating and hunger. I had to deal with, you know, not eating when I wanted to while I was at school waiting for lunch, and then by the time lunchtime came around, I wasn't hungry anymore. So now I can't recognize hunger, and sometimes when I get anxiety, I lose all ability to try and eat anything, even if it's my favorite food. So how do you retrain yourself to recognize hunger and recognize that you need to go and eat?
I think this is a really interesting question. I'm really sorry to hear that. And I think it's probably more common, as with many eating problems, than people would allow. I did meet a psychologist once and asked him, why is it in response to stress, some people have the urge to eat more and some people have the urge to eat less? And he didn't really have a good answer except to say, yes, it does seem to affect people in these radically different ways. It definitely is possible to learn to get better at recognizing hunger cues in your own body. I mean, I think in your case, it might be most of us, the problem is learning how to recognize when it's real hunger and not responding so much to the food cues around us and trying to tune those out. Whereas in your case, it sounds as if your body is sending you strong signals not to eat at exactly the points where you need to eat. So maybe just the process of adopting very structured meal times and saying, I'm going to be led by the clock, I'm going to eat at this time, and being kind to yourself. Because, I mean, all of these problems with eating are really difficult, and anxiety kind of feeds on anxiety and it becomes worse. So baby steps and small meals, and I would say fixed meal times, but really good luck with this. It sounds difficult.
My guest is Bea Wilson. She's a food writer and historian with a new book out called First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org, send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open, with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with food writer Bea Wilson about her new book, First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Bea, in the U.S., conversations about better health habits and better eating specifically tend to start from a place of personal responsibility. If you eat well, it's to your credit. If you eat poorly, it's your fault. What are the pros and cons of looking at healthful eating from a societal perspective as opposed to something that individuals must figure out for themselves?
Well, there's a lot that individuals can do. I think the problem with the language of personal responsibility is it often segues into a kind of moralizing about food, which is profoundly unhelpful as well as just quite unpleasant. There's this way in which people use this word willpower as a kind of moral stick with which to beat the overweight or the obese. But given that 2/3 of the population, give or take, in the United States is now overweight or obese, it's become the norm. And it's in all our interest to figure out actually how the other third of the population has managed somehow to protect themselves in this obesogenic world. The question of individual responsibility versus societal responsibility, I think it's worth looking at the two together. In my final chapter, which is called Change, I looked at Japan. And from the perspective of either the US or the UK, Japan seems to have this enviable relationship with food. They've got very low obesity levels, but they're one of the few countries in the world to have such low obesity without also having famine. And they also seem to have this wonderful, pleasurable relationship with food. They sing songs to sushi. There are theme parks devoted to noodles. It's a joy in Japan. It's part of the national conversation. And it's really easy to look at Japan from the outside and think, oh, we could never be Japan. We have a completely different culture, whether it's in the UK or the US. It's some innate Japanese-ness that enables them to eat like that. But when you look into it, you find, no, absolutely not so. The Japanese have only eaten this near-ideal diet for a really short period of time. It's really just a phenomenon of the post-war years, and it was a series of social and economic changes which enabled them to eat in this way. If it happened to Japan, actually, we should take hope from Japan. The US could definitely adopt a different national diet. There's not something innate about America that means that burgers and fries have to be your national food. And indeed, plenty of Americans already don't eat like that.
When you say a national diet, are you talking about some kind of government initiative? Or are you talking about something that comes from the ground up? How would that work?
I think it needs to happen in a whole combination of ways at once. I do think there could be more government initiatives, because if you look at the main way that people make their food choices, it's down to availability. So if you change somewhat the availability of what's in the food supply, you would automatically change people's preferences and choices. But I also think there's a whole lot that individuals can do, even now, even with the existing food supply, to protect themselves more, which is largely to do with this question of, if we tweak our tastes enough to the point where when you look in the supermarket and instead of thinking, oh, I'm so tempted by all of these wonderful convenience foods, you just think, no, this food doesn't really speak to me anymore. I don't want that. And you're naturally heading more towards the fresh produce section, towards the whole foods, because that's what you want to eat. Well, that's a great place to be.
How does gender affect the way we're taught to eat?
I think it affects it to a surprising extent. You wouldn't really think that in this day and age, people would still be feeding boys and girls differently. But there's a lot of evidence across cultures, ranging from the United States to Japan to France, that we do still feed boys and girls in very different ways. Obviously not in every family, but enough that it can be measured statistically. And there's this pervasive notion that somehow red meat and hearty foods are for boys, and that girls are meant to somehow subsist on lettuce leaves and chocolate and compliments. And if you look at the nutritional requirements of boys and girls, exactly the opposite is the case. Across the world, this is interesting. It really is seen in different places. It's in Thailand, it's in the United States. Boys eat significantly fewer vegetables than girls. And both sexes suffer from child obesity, but boys somewhat more so. So they are the ones that we should be saying eat salad to. Girls, conversely, the biggest nutritional need that they have as they enter puberty is for more iron. Without necessarily having full-blown anemia, a lot of girls suffer from iron deficiencies to some extent. So we should be saying to girls, eat man food, eat hearty main courses. If anyone needs red meat, and arguably maybe nobody does, but if anyone does, it would be girls and not boys.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Suzanne on the line now in McKinney. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. I think just answered my question. I feel like I have known more male picky eaters in my life than female, although I was lucky enough to marry a man that eats anything I put in front of him. And I, again, was just curious if that picky eater attitude seems to, is it more pervasive for males?
I think it may be more pervasive for males. Something really interesting that I came across was there's new research suggesting that anorexia may be something that happens often in the female brain, which is in some ways analogous to autism, because it's a kind of obsession with systems. It just is one that's playing out in a completely different way. And a lot of profound picky eating in kids is related to being on the autistic spectrum. So you have autistic spectrum where it's, well, let's say majority boys, but a minority of girls. And then you have anorexia where it's majority girls, minority boys. I see these as maybe two different ways that eating goes wrong for the two sexes. But obviously, there are also girls who are picky eaters. You do come across girls who eat nothing but hot dogs. There was a case study that a director of a feeding clinic told me about of an 18-year-old girl who had made her selection of college entirely based on finding one that served margarita pizza twice a day in the canteen. And she went to the canteen and checked it, and there was no oregano or any spice. So that was the university that she was going to study at.
So when I was a kid, we didn't keep ice cream in the house, but if you won like student of the month, then the whole family got to go out for ice cream, and it was all very exciting. Is it wrong to use food as a reward?
I think at some level it's almost impossible not to, because food is a currency of celebration, but it's how often you do it and it's how you do it. And it's, you don't want children exclusively to think that every time something good happens in life, they need sugar. You don't want to reach the point where celebration foods are in your life every single day. Well, apart from anything else, they're not such a celebration then. I mean, that sounds like a lovely family ritual that you had. And presumably that didn't happen, what, every couple of weeks?
Yeah, or? We didn't win awards that often.
That sounds to me a really good way to do it. I mean, the thinking on food and rewards has changed somewhat. It used to be thought that you should never reward a child for trying unfamiliar foods. The latest research shows from, this is from the UK, but it's from someone called Dr. Lucy Cook, who pioneered this tiny taste system of building up your taste through trying unfamiliar vegetables in the size of a pea or even a grain of rice. And she found that you could get children to comply with this much better if you gave them a sticker. So her thought is, yes, it's a really silly idea to say, eat your broccoli and then you can have chocolate cake, because all that does is it makes you like the broccoli less and the chocolate cake more. But if you say, try this tiny piece of broccoli and I'll give you a sticker, that's actually a good thing, because the child feels a warm glow of happiness about both the sticker, and that then transfers to the broccoli.
Interesting idea, too, to try to introduce new foods at snack time, which is a little bit less fraught with the need to make sure that a child gets enough calories in.
Exactly. This was another of Lucy Cook's ideas. Her point is that for many children, if you look at their likes and dislikes, the single biggest dislike, and maybe this comes back to the listener earlier who was so stressed and unhappy at mealtimes, the single biggest dislike is mealtimes themselves, just sitting there at the dinner table being expected to put something in your mouth when you are scared or worried that you won't be able to do it. So if you make the time of day when you try new foods a time that's totally separate from mealtimes, just do it when you're out on a trip, or do it at snack time or playtime, the whole fraughtness around food evaporates.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Diane on the line in Plano. Hey, Diane.
Hi. Hi. I was just wondering if your guest had any thoughts on food cravings, like having an idea, oh, I really want to eat Chinese food today, or, you know, is that telling you you need some kind of nutrient, or I just want to have steak, you know?
That's a good question. What do you know about that, Bea?
That is a good question. I think a lot of us think that this is how we're relating to food. It comes back to the Clara Davis experiment earlier, and this idea, the wisdom of the body, that somehow our body is telling us what we need and we can just interpret it. And, you know, our vitamin C levels are dropping and we need to instantly eat a kiwi fruit to get them up again. I wish that it did work like this, but the evidence from lots of studies, both with humans, and there have been ones done with rats as well, because rats are omnivores like us, suggests that actually we're not very good necessarily at reading our own cravings. We might be craving something just because we're somewhat addicted to it. We might be, I mean, I know what you mean about that thing where you suddenly wake up and you feel you want something different today because it's just that sort of day. And I think we all have those moments. And there may be certain stages of life when you hormonally, famously in pregnancy, people crave different foods. But the idea that cravings will tell us absolutely what our body needs, I wish it were so, but unfortunately, I think it probably isn't.
if we're craving something that we know to be not necessarily an important part of our diet, right? We want a piece of chocolate cake. Mm. Is it better to just have a little bit of chocolate cake or to fight against it knowing that that's not really what we want to be eating? I mean, we want to be eating it, but we don't think we should.
I think if we... The evidence from long-term dieters who've been successful shows that the ones who managed to keep the weight off for the longest period of time were the ones who did allow themselves a little bit of what they wanted now and then. If eating is a battle every single day, then that isn't a very sustainable way to live, and it's certainly not a very happy one. And I think any diet, including a healthy, balanced diet, should be able to accommodate the odd slice of chocolate cake.
I think we have time quickly for one more call from Karen and Ulysses. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have kids who are picky eaters, and I'm kind of going backwards. My question is, how do you get a child or an adult who has that texture problem of seeds or the way something feels in their mouth, it doesn't feel good to them, that they won't eat the food even though they like the flavor of it?
This is really difficult. I mean, and a lot of the problems with picky eating do have some kind of physical cause. So they may have some sort of oral defensiveness, and presumably you've taken them to doctors to discuss it if it's getting to the point where you're really worried about it. I mean, one thing which I've done with my own third child, who was my picky eater, who was born with cleft palate, if the rest of us are having some kind of hearty soup or stew, and I know he likes the flavours and he just looks at it and says, I can't eat that, it's gross, I just puree it for him. And it's not a good idea to be eating things which are totally smooth all of the time. You need to have crunchy foods, you need to have some work for your jaw, you need to learn how to eat other textures. But if for that one meal the flavour is something that appeals and the texture doesn't, and they would like it in a smooth form, I would just go with that as an option.
I'm curious, Bea, are you the sort of person who makes New Year's resolutions?
Not anymore.
Really?
I did once. I would start the year I do have kind of, my New Year's resolution is I'm quite a good cook. I'm a terrible gardener. And I was just looking at my garden, which is such a mess, and thinking, oh, this is the year I'm going to finally plant herbs and not kill them, and I'll remember to water them. That's my New Year's resolution. But I don't think I want to resolve to lose 14 pounds by the time it's February and I'm going to go running every day. And no, because I know that those kinds of resolutions don't generally work. I think the kinds that do work are positive behaviour changes, like saying, I'm going to try a new vegetable each month, or slow changes. I'm not saying you shouldn't say I'm going to go to the gym, but go to the gym and try out a load of different classes until you find one you really like, and then maybe you'll stick with that.
Bea Wilson is a historian and food writer. Her new book is called First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. Bea, thanks very much for joining us, and good luck with your garden this summer.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. If you want to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.